Hey guys, welcome tonight. My name is Uncle Jim, and I'm an alcoholic, and it's great to be here. I had the privilege this morning of getting on the phone with Tom. Not only Tom, Father Tom. Now, some of you might say, why would we call him Father Tom? You're Uncle Jim, he's Father Tom. What's going on here? Well, actually, Father Tom is an ordained Jesuit priest, and he's allowing me to share that. He's a real priest. He came into AA back in 1976 from the little tiny town of Berkeley, California. And one of his favorite things is, I like this one day at a time, one day at a time. And it was just a great honor to speak to him today, even though our phone got cut off a few times. I don't have my paper here tonight, so if anybody could wrap up my last my last sentence, I'd appreciate that. Well, why don't we go ahead and give a big round of applause to Father Tom from Oakland.
I'm Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. And glad to be with you this evening in Visalia, Central California. I've been living in Oakland since 1981, and my oldest brother lives in Kingsburg, which is not far from you. And so I've driven through you a couple of times. I think I've been to a couple of meetings in your neighborhood, but most of my since quarantine, I have pretty much been in Oakland since March 15th. When I was in Fresno just before the quarantine happened, there was a big fundraiser for the Fresno Fellowship, central office maybe, called Bring Your Sponsor to Dinner. And I got to go there, and I saw some people I hadn't seen in a long time. And I talked to a couple of old-timers who were pretty active in the program in the 1950s. And somewhere in the 1950s, and I don't know if it's 1954 or 1958, in the Fresno community, their discussion was, should we get a telephone for central office? Because up to that point, if you wanted to join Alcoholics Anonymous, you wrote a letter to Bill Wilson in New York. At least that's what a lot of people did. They wrote the New York office, and then it would kind of be, you know, passed around. And are we going to have a telephone? Will we embrace this new technology? And they discussed it for 3 months, because that's what we do, you know. We don't like new ideas, and we don't like change, and everything's suspicious. And they finally voted in a phone. And so that was in early March, and then quarantine happened. And here, the meetings I go to in the East Bay, mostly Oakland and a few other spots, everyone was Zooming within like a week. That technological switch happened very, very fast. And one of my pals hates the idea of Zoom. He disapproves of it for 100 different reasons, and he won't play. And this won't surprise you, but he hates anything new and any change. So he gets to be miserable, because that's the freedom, you know, of the 12 steps. I don't mind Zoom. I found it pretty easy. I mean, I'd be willing to drive to Visalia. But this week, in the last 10 days, I've been to a meeting in Jakarta, Indonesia. And 2 weeks ago, I guess, I was at a meeting in Jerusalem. And over the weekend, I got to be in a meeting in Los Angeles. And a lot of times, I don't know anybody there, but I will recognize some familiar faces, and it's really very, very nice. So anyway, Zoom, we may be doing this for a while. We're pretty much all shut down. I help out at a local parish, and I've been doing that for 20 years. I don't run anything, and I'm not in charge of anything, but I help out weekdays. And we just started barely moving again. And there's like me and a couple of people and a camera. And maybe in July, people have to come in. And we've been having a couple of AA meetings at this place over the last few years. And, you know, we have, I got sober in 1976. So among jobs, you had people who would set up the chairs. I did that. That was people who would clean the ashtrays. That was considered a full-time job, if you remember back that far. Coffee cups, cleaning coffee cups, that's also another job. Taking out the trash. And the new job is going to be disinfecting everything after the meeting so that the next group can come in. And I think this can be done simply and easily, but it's what you do. The first tradition talks about the common welfare and learning how to think about the common welfare of everybody is makes some of us our brains hurt because we've just never done it before. And I was told the common welfare means at some point everyone gets to be inconvenienced. You're going to have to make way for someone else coming in, or it's what we do. And I remember the smoking wars a few years ago. You know, will this be a smoking meeting or a non-smoking meeting? All meetings smoked. I mean, everybody smoked. It was what we did. I remember watching the news shows. We would watch Huntley and Brinkley every night at 6 o'clock in San Jose during dinner. And I loved Huntley Brinkley because then we didn't have to talk to anybody. And Chet Huntley smoked on the air, you know, and Edward R. Murrow smoked on the air. Anyway. I went to central office and asked if here in Oakland, and I asked if we could have a non-smoking meeting. And the response was, we don't have any non-smoking meetings. I'd like to start one. And again, this was a new idea, you know, and it had to be processed. But I'd been sober enough, long enough to know you don't want to. Here's our Tuesday meeting at 8 o'clock, and everyone has been smoking here for 100 years. We want to vote to make it a non-smoking meeting. Those 40 people will vote next week, and the next week 300 people would show up militantly doing one side or the other. So rather than changing a meeting, because we hate change, we'll start a new meeting. And we started the meeting, and about 40 people showed up the first time. And, you know, the common welfare is that people can breathe. And I think that took 10 years to work out something that obvious. So the common welfare, anyway, I have opinions on everything. Glad to be here, glad for Zoom, and for the next half hour, a little more than that. Happy to tell you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. Grew up, I'm a California guy. Grew up in San Jose. We had friends in Bakersfield. And my dad had a friend further in Southern California. So every summer we would drive down 99 and visit our friends in Bakersfield and go down to Southern California. San Jose was 100,000 people, and it was agriculture, and I remember orchards. I'd been drunk in orchards. I had driven cars drunk in orchards. Alcohol was in the house. It was part of the norm. Drinking was normal. We had functional alcoholics in my family. Drinking was considered pretty normal. I think there's an uncle on my dad's side that disappeared. And my father's both parents came from Ireland and before the turn of the last century. And I think my father's father worked as a gardener at Stanford University for 40 years. This is when the Irish were the day laborers. So we'd been here for a while. We never talked about alcoholism. I mean, it was, I remember my dad, who I'm pretty sure was alcoholic, referred to one of his friends as being an alcoholic. And it was kind of a shameful thing. And I think this was a guy who got much sicker, much faster, and much worse. And I remember he had kids about my age, and we'd go over there and play, but his name was Bill. Had sick from alcoholism. And I didn't know anything about it, and I didn't want to know anything about it. I moved to Berkeley in 1974 to do my theology studies. I'd been in the order a long time. I'd been to school, and you learn philosophy and you learn literature, and they'd love it if you would do a couple of languages, you know, so you have some usefulness. And I did some Spanish, and I did some Latin, I did some Greek. But I never learned anything about alcoholism. When I was very young in the order, so I'm 20 years old, a retreat was being given to the older fellows who were in their in first studies by a priest by the name of Barney Nixon. And Barney Nixon was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was from the Northwest, and he was a high school guy, high school administrator, and drank himself out of that job and ended up a complete train wreck and got sober and began doing retreats for people in recovery. So he now had a reputation of being kind of a miracle story. And he gave an 8-day retreat to the guys in first studies. And as a novice, we were allowed to go in once a day and hear him because he was considered remarkable. So I got to hear a sober alcoholic priest. I didn't run up and talk and become best friends. I had all the signs of early alcoholism, but I wasn't ready to talk to anybody about it. So I get to Berkeley, and one of the guys in my community had been through treatment. His name was John. He was from the Midwest. And he was obsessed with rabbits. And he liked people calling him the rabbit. And he had stuffed bunnies all over his room. And he was not drinking, and he made a big deal out of that. And he would give people lectures on alcoholism. I don't know if he ever went to a meeting, but I didn't find him attractive or interesting, but I thought, this is a crazy person. And by this time, I'm having trouble. I'm blackouts, of course. I was having those in high school. This isn't passing out, which I've also done. It's blacking out. One of my friends, she was a mom living in Los Angeles, and she didn't know she was passing out either. She just noticed she took naps all over the house, and she'd just wake up on the floor, you know, or wake up on the couch, and all the passing out. I did some of that blacking out. The real clincher for me, the thing that made me scared most, was the changes in personality. I was pretty sure I was losing my mind. I was behaving erratically. I would drink and be no longer friendly, get involved in these huge arguments, which I used to think was entertainment. You know, let's argue politics. Let's argue religion. I now see it as mental illness, but at the time, I thought it was a great way to spend time. And I was known for being one of these loud-mouthed, opinionated drunks. More isolated. I went out with a classmate. We both got drunk. I began behaving very badly, loudly, crazy, and the Berkeley police stopped me. They were going to take me in for being drunk and disorderly. And my friend talked him out of it. If he had a little more Al-Anon, he just would have let it happen. But he talked him out of it and got me home. And the next morning I woke up knowing the evening had gotten away from me. This is, again, this is, so I called my friend and I said, what happened last night? And he said, what's the last thing you remember? And I mentioned something, and then he said, well, let's start with the police. And he just went down the list of erratic behavior on my part, where I was just impossible. And when I heard that, I was seeing a therapist to try to figure out why I drink badly. And the decision I made when my friend was telling me how crazy I acted, the decision I made was I can no longer drink with people who know me. You know, I can't do any public drinking anymore. I'm going to keep drinking, but I better be more isolated and privatized. I did some barroom drinking in bars where I didn't know anyone. I wouldn't talk to anybody. But I would kind of go into bar world and then drive home, of course. And I remember talking to the therapist that afternoon, and he was over in San Francisco. I took a bus to go see him. And I remember saying, you know, maybe it's possible that I might be alcoholic by some stretch of the imagination. And he said, oh, there's no doubt. He said, you are. There's no doubt but that you're an alcoholic. And he didn't say try AA. That if he mentioned it, I didn't hear it. What he suggested that I do was not drink and come and see him the next week. He was just a little bit older than I was. And I did that for a while. And so I went through a dry period, wasn't drinking and wasn't going to meetings. And it was just awful. Whether I'm drinking or not, I was very obsessed with it. And then there were a few more attempts of staying dry and getting drunk and staying dry and getting drunk. And I finally, in the community to which I belong, they have some education and some sophistication, and they have a policy for dealing with alcoholics. And when you have an alcoholic in your group, you want to get them some treatment. So I was 29 years old. I'm now in my 74th year. I was 29, and I went through a three-week program in Berkeley that was very, very AA-friendly. And I learned a couple of things, and I'm going to wrap up by talking about those couple of things and welcome people with 3 days and, you know, 6 months. I mean, it's so odd to not be drunk. I remember someone saying the normal thing for people like us is to be drunk. So if you're not drunk, you're in an abnormal state for an alcoholic. So expect to feel awkward, you know. One of the things they told me was to go to a lot of meetings and to not drink in between meetings and to not use no dope. Now, this is very important. I'd been smoking marijuana for years because it's such a sweet drug. And especially during those times when I wasn't drinking, I'd use marijuana because it is such a lovely experience. But when I was at my first meeting, we go to lots of meetings, we don't drink, we don't use. I just believed them. And I stopped. Clean and sober is how it was explained to me. And I went to a lot of meetings and I found relief at meetings. I didn't feel fixed, but I felt relief. And I don't know if I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, but there were days I went to 2 meetings and 3 meetings. And I would get all wrapped up inside my head and in my body, and I didn't know what to do with it. A meeting would help. So get to a meeting is helpful for me. Doing this a day at a time. I've got some time on the program, and the way it was explained to me, any day, I can get through. And at the end of the day, I can say I haven't had a drink or a joint or a pill all day. That day is a huge success, no matter what else happened. I remember hearing that, and I remember choosing to believe that. And a year or two later, I moved to Los Angeles to go back to teaching school, which is what I thought I'd be doing forever, high school kids. And one of those days, my second year or third year in recovery, everything was so awful all day long. Hot, miserable, bad air, bad students, bad teachers, bad school. And I remember, and I went to a lot of meetings down there too, but I remember ending the day in my room on the third floor of Loyola High School. And I said, the only thing that went right today is I didn't have a drink or a joint or a pill. It's a success. And I still believe that. I think I get a daily reprieve from the worst of my crazy, but I've got crazy. I have attitudes and I have obsessions and I have reactions. All that happens. And usually I'm traveling a lot and driving a lot and flying a lot. Home. I garden. I do some yard work in the morning, in the front or in the back. I cut back some roses. I water things. I feed the goldfish in the bathtub. Today I've done a major laundry thing plus a major cat box cleaning, new litter, everything. And I cooked dinner for the brothers. And I read a bit. And I took a nap today. Here I am. A lot of days have been a lot like that. Tomorrow I expect to have a similar day and doing a Zoom meeting. And I've talked to 3 or 4 or 5 people by phone today. People seem to need the telephone contact. And one person was going to call me at noon and there was no call. And I waited till 12:30 and then I did something else. It's okay. Day at a time and daily reprieve from the worst of my crazy. Someone explained to me that the word reprieve is usually only used by governors, you know, and it has to do with death row. The guys on death row can get a reprieve from the governor, and we've got a daily reprieve from a terrible malady. I like being alive. I like being sober. My sponsor's in LA. I stay in touch with him. We talk on the phone, and since March 15th, there have been a couple of times when I have gone back to bed more than once because I didn't know what else to do. So I give myself a lot of permission. I'm reading a history or two. There's a history of the program called Writing the Big Book. It's a great big thick thing that just came out. I'm reading that. I'm reading a few other things. I like murder mysteries. Today's simple. I want to keep it real. Simple. And I can also say for everyone who is predicting the next 6 weeks or 6 months or 6 years, no one knows anything. And I'm staying right here in the present today because this is what I know. So that's a whole bunch. Topic-wise, what I've always found helpful are practical conversations. I've been to meetings where sometimes the subject is very theoretical, and those drive me crazy. But a practical topic. And I find here in the middle of quarantine, steps 1, 2, and 3 are really very useful for people like me. The powerlessness and the unmanageability. My original plan was these last 2 weeks of June, I was going to be in Stockholm, Sweden, doing Stockholm Swedish stuff. And here I am, you know, in Oakland, California, hanging out with people in Visalia. And it's just fine. I'm kind of relieved that I don't have to fly anywhere, but we're here today. Present. As powerless, unmanageable, I understand step 2 as being about hope. Step 2 lets me know there's a way out of the trap. There's a way out of the cage. And in the third step, I turn things over and I turn things over and I focus and I stay awake and I try to tell the truth and I let go of the results. Because there's a lot I don't know. So I think that's enough. But if you want to talk about something, any of your experiences with steps 1, 2, and 3 are always good news. I was listening to an Al-Anon lady a while ago, and she said she was convinced she needed every one of the 12 steps except step 2. She did not think she was nuts, and she really was, like a lot of us are, you know, needing the fellowship and needing the connection. Enough.
You know what might be a good idea, Monica, is if you have a question, put your hand up in the participants panel, and we'll call on you so that we can be sure we're not talking over each other. And while we're waiting for people to do that, I wonder, Tom, if I could ask you a question. I know we hear a lot about this idea of letting go and letting God. That was kind of the last point you talked about. Can you offer any practical examples of a time when you've been able to let go and let God? What does that look like?
I'm not in charge of any of the results. I mean, I want to control the outcome. You know, in Al-Anon they taught there's a phrase they use in Al-Anon. It's controlling the outcome or managing the outcome. There's a special phrasing they use where I get to be in charge and I get to manage and fix things. And that's exactly what I don't get to do in the third step. I'm in charge of paying the bill, answering the phone, returning the phone call, getting the check in the mail. That's all the stuff I'm responsible for, but not the outcome. And I asked my sponsor once, what does any of this God's will stuff mean? And he said, it is God's will for each of us to have a life. Go get one. Which means making decisions and trying things out and seeing what makes sense and what doesn't make sense and what's possible and not possible. But I turn, the footwork is just crucial. And I try to keep it very, very practical. When I'm faced with a conundrum, and there's lots of those, the questions I ask are what's practical, what's possible, and what's simple. And that's the direction I go in. And then again, the results, it happens or it doesn't happen. When I think I had 8 or 9 airplane flights that I've had to cancel. We'll work this out somehow, you know. I've been married to United Airlines for 20 years, and we'll see if there even is a United Airlines in 6 months or so, you know. Cancel the ticket. That's something I can do. Let people know. Ask for help. Keep it simple. Stay in the present. And lots of times I don't know what's happening, and lots of times I don't know what's going on. We'll see. There's in Spanish, I have a very rudimentary Spanish, but one of the great Spanish things is mañana. You know, mañana. Well, it'll work out tomorrow. And in Arabic, they say inshallah. You know, if this is God's will, inshallah, if things work out. And I did go to some meetings in United Arab Emirates and some of those very exotic places. And I said, so what's the difference between inshallah and mañana? And they said, well, inshallah is mañana, but without the urgency. Things will work out. Or not. Relax. Be here. Breathe. Use both lungs. Breathe. Use both lungs. That's something you can do. So I tend to do that. I got a call today from a sponsee, and she's very upset because people at meetings are behaving badly. And I said, so how is this your business? You know, people have behaved badly at meetings forever, you know, so relax, mind your own business. You don't have to say an AA. from people who behave badly. Such a freedom.
Thank you, sir. And Susie has a question. Susie, you want to go ahead and unmute yourself?
Hi, Tom. This is Susie, the alcoholic.
Hi, Susie.
It was wonderful to hear your story. I know at first when you were sharing, you were talking a lot about traditions and how the program has evolved. And I just wanted to say that I appreciated you sharing on that as well, because there's one thing that I believe is constant, and that's change. Mm-hmm. And we definitely have to do our best to adapt and overcome, you know, in all areas of life, including in the program. So thank you for sharing that. My question for you is regarding your step five. What advice would you give those that are new in the program and that have the fear, the shame, and guilt that goes with being honest, not just with themselves, but with another person?
Yeah.
And in discussing your experience when you initially went through that step five.
Yeah, I can do that. I think I have as much fear, shame, and self-loathing as anybody else on the block. And I'm from a religious tradition where we've gone to confession, so part of the deal was to talk to somebody as honestly as you could, even from the time you were a kid. So it wasn't a brand new idea, but I was still very reluctant to do it. I didn't want the vulnerability, and I had a lot of confusion about me. And I started writing my fourth step whenever I was upset. And then as soon as I calmed down, I stopped writing. So it took me about a year and a half to do a fourth step. And I remember taking off 2 weeks and doing a week-long retreat just to get the thing done. And I was almost 2 years sober. I was going to be 2 years sober. I made a date with my sponsor to read him my fifth step. And I had a lot of anxiety. So I wrote about resentments and anger. And I wrote about fears. And I wrote about sexual stuff. And I wrote about craziness concerning money, because those are all big crazy areas for people's lives, you know. And I made lists. I did not write the great American novel. I kind of followed the format in the book, you know, the format, you know, what happened and who's involved and what was my part. So I did that. And then I chose to do mine with my sponsor. You don't have to do yours with your sponsor, but I chose to do mine with my sponsor because I had a huge amount of reluctance to trust anybody. And so this was going to be a major trust thing. I was going to tell him some stuff that I hadn't put together and presented to anybody before. And he's also a priest. He's 9 years older than me. Much more introverted than I am. But I'd watched him for a year in Los Angeles, and I knew he didn't gossip. I knew he didn't abuse people. I know he was respectful. And I also knew he was kind. I mean, also a truth teller, but he was kind. So I did my fifth step with someone I knew something about. And as I presented him this list of boring, repetitive, self-obsessed, whiny stuff, he just listened. And I remember once I read him something that was, we would politely say it was ambiguous, you know. And I knew I had to make it very clear what I was talking about. So I did. And I didn't look at him. I remember explaining it to the floor, you know. So I just said A, B, C. Well, what was going on there was, and I did that. And I think it took an hour or so to do the fifth step, maybe. I don't think it has to be a 3-day enterprise or 17 hours, you know, with a lunch break. Get it done. And at the end of my time with him, he said, well, one thing's real clear. And I went, oh, no, you know, it's gonna, the judgment is coming. And he said, both you and I need this program very much, which was the perfect solution or perfect response. And then we didn't discuss it for 2 hours. I just kind of said some stuff out loud. I did not feel instantly better. I did not feel great relief. I felt, okay, I've done it. You know, I have punched the clock. I went to a meeting that night in central Los Angeles. And they said, you look awful. What happened? I did my best of us. Sit here. We'll get you coffee. And they sat down. And over the next 6 or 7 months, I felt better. It was like I got lighter. It's so important to do. You want to do it quickly. And there's a lot of helps to it. Some of us, we just overthink it too much. Get it done. And I've had this experience, you know, I used to travel a lot, and I'd go someplace and someone would say, you know, small town, Nebraska. They'd say, I did my fifth step with my sponsor and I mentioned almost everything. Can I mention a couple of things to you? And of course the answer is yes, because there's stuff we're ashamed of. Sometimes it's financial stuff and sometimes it's sexual stuff. And some people, you know, they have a lot of guilt and shame and fear. And if you can talk about that, it alleviates some of that. If you can talk to someone who can hear it. So I think doing it helps the process of healing. And if you're reluctant, lots of us are reluctant to get it done. And I had a guy call me years ago, and boy, he had this manuscript of crap, you know, and he said it's going to take 4 days of my listening to his thing. And I've done it before, so I know it takes 4 days. And I remember just thinking, you know, I don't have 4 days to listen to anybody like that. No one is that interesting. And please, can you cut it down to 3 pages and, you know, leave off the repetitions, you know, anything big. But some of us are grandiose and very self-obsessed. But most of us are really very boring. And to hear, learning how to hear and learning how to listen with kindness is, that was my experience. He was very kind. And he's been my sponsor over 40 years. So I get to hear some fourth steps and fifth steps. And I usually just listen. It's theirs, not mine. Occasionally, if it's appropriate, I might share some of my own stuff, but it's not my fifth step. But sometimes people need to know they're not the only one who ever had that experience. And we come into the light. And what a relief. What a relief. So it's an important thing just to get done. It's just another step, get it done. You know, good old step five.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, and we have a great question from Jen. Jen, if you'd like to unmute yourself.
Hi, I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. This has been really, really informative and just great. My question is, I don't know your details, but I'm assuming you were a man of faith before finding sobriety. And my question is, how did your relationship with your higher power change before finding sobriety in AA and after? Thank you.
Well, yeah, alcoholics, we get very isolated and we get full of fear and anger and shame. And that sure gets in the way. And a lot of times I didn't even have words to understand the struggle. But it was tough. I mean, who isn't miserable in 20th century America? You know, I mean, it's a struggle. Get in there, fight. Coming into recovery, it's been much more helpful. I've been able to hear women and men who are also alcoholics talk about coming to and coming to believe and being of service. And I find that very helpful. A lot of my stuff was because I thought I was unique, special, and different. And I'm not. I'm one of the folks. And I found it difficult to pray when I was drinking and using, and I sometimes still find it difficult to pray now. And sometimes it's easy to turn things over, and sometimes I'm very reluctant to turn things over. So I do this a day at a time.
Okay, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Tom, for joining us today. We are at the end of our meeting.